This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
This work, and it's our job just to go home and pop some popcorn and curl up on the couch to watch Transformers. Well, then next time, they might just win. Let's not let that happen.
Cyber social justice activist Aaron Swartz committed suicide Friday. He was 26 years old. To get a copy of our show, go to our website, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8:02. Coming up next is more talk radio with hosts Cecil Prescott and Celeste Carey. Today's guest is Frank Schaefer, author of the recent article on Alternet entitled America's White Male Problem. Schaefer claims that the continuous attempt by the white far right in Congress to shut down the government rather than work with our black president has a lot to do with deeply entrenched racism.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud media sponsor of the Q Center Winter Gala, Fire and Ice. Fire and Ice will be held at Castaway Portland, 1900 Northwest 18th Avenue, on Saturday, January 26th. The VIP party begins at 6 p.m. and general admission is at 7. Entertainment includes a performance by two-time Grammy Award winner Matt Albert and much more. Information about the Q Center Winter Gala can be found at kboo.fm/2013fireandice.
Hi, this is Joanne Hardesty. Join me on Thursday, January 17th from 8 to 9 for a conversation with City Commissioner Amanda Fritz. What are her priorities for this new term? What are your questions for her? Please join me on Thursday, January 17th from 8 to 9 for Voices from the Edge on KBOO.fm Portland.
Good morning.
Good morning.
You're listening to More Talk Radio here on your community radio station, KBOO.
Portland, 90.7 here in the metro area, 91.9 in the Columbia River Gorge, 100.7 in the Willamette River Valley, and in the ether on the web, it is www.kboo. Good morning.
My name is Cecil Prescott.
I thought we said
did
names.
We say that?
Well, okay. I'm still Celeste Carey.
Are you still? Okay.
Thank you for the test. I think I'm awake now.
Okay. Well, joining us this morning is Frank Schaefer, who's written extensively on several books and volumes and columns. He has appeared in Huffington Post and Alternet and in many other periodicals. He recently wrote an article that was published in Alternet entitled America's White Male Problem. In it, he argues convincingly about how we often misperceive what are some of the challenges that our nation face and how to confront them. He is the author of many books, and we thank you, Mr. Schaefer, for joining us this morning.
Hey, it's my pleasure. How are you, Cecil?
I'm doing well. I must admit that I am one of those children who went to the university in the 70s who was influenced by a lot of what your father wrote and have journeyed since that place, as we all have. And so you've written about your background, and you have, you know, some of your books are greatly entitled Crazy for God, How I Grew Up as One of the Elect, Helped Found the Religious Right, and Live to Take All, or Almost All of It's Back. The second volume, in what you term as a God trilogy, is Patience with God, Faith for People Who Don't Like Religion or Atheism, and Sex, Mom, and God, How the Bible's Strange Take on Sex Led to Crazy Politics, and How I Learned to Love Women and Jesus Anyway. Do you come up with these titles?
Yeah, I come up with the title and the subtitle. You know, a lot of times publishers will change them, but they seem to like these. And, you know, the titles are all short, Crazy for God, Patience with God, Sex, Mom, and God. And then I tend to like putting a very descriptive, fun subtitle on the book, which of course appears in smaller print under the title, like Crazy for God, and then draws people in because they're sitting there at a bookstore or online saying, what on earth could this be? And then, of course, that's a great question to ask about a book. And maybe you have a new reader there. So titles are meant to pull people into books, and that's why the long subtitles, the kind of amusing subtitles, are on those covers.
Now those are great.
Great titles, yes. And I think what you've done is you captured the spirit of the generation as well when you put in all those little subtitles, things we're looking for. And one of the wonderful, beautiful things about the titles is the fact that it gives us a glimpse into who you are and what kind of credentials you're bringing to this whole effort.
Well, you know, when it comes to the article you mentioned at the top of the show, the white male problem that's on Alternet right now, and the reaction to that, of course, I built a background for that article in Crazy for God, where I talk about the fact that my late father, who died in 1984, Francis Schaefer, toward the end of his life, became known as one of the leaders and founders of the religious right. And in the book, I tell the story of how, in the kind of nepotistic tradition that, you know, goes with places like North Korea, but also with evangelical empires, I became his sidekick on the road for about 10 years, and then finally got out of the evangelical community and adopted a much more progressive politics and also Christianity over the years. I tell that story, so the story is really about our family and my own journey. And then, of course, you know, to come more into the present, I guess for the last 6 years now, since President Obama got into the primaries in his first run at the presidency, and then also through this next election, I had been one of the first bloggers on Huffington Post, and I wrote a lot about why I supported the president. And really, this article, The White Male Problem, comes out of the fact that I'd been just scratching my head wondering what on earth has gone wrong in this country where the vicious attacks that President Obama has endured and the lies, everything from the birthers to his so-called death panels he was going to unleash if he reformed health care, not born in America, a Muslim, a secret communist, nothing too crazy here, even the Antichrist. You know, what was this extra venom that had entered our politics? And up into including the 87 freshman congressmen who came in at the midterm elections, who have done everything they can to make the wheels come off, not just our electoral process and politics, but actually have been willing to sacrifice the good name and faith and credit of the U.S. economy worldwide in their fight to not do anything positive, but just stop whatever the first African-American president of the United States wants to do. And so really that article in Alternet, The White Male Problem, is about the fact that we've got to be honest, and even though it's really something people don't really want to talk about, we live under a racist cloud in this country, but there's something else that goes with it, and that is a shrinking white male right-wing minority that really sees the future in total, with or without President Obama, as a threat. It's a future in which women are powerful, in which black men and women are given their more and more rightful place, in which Hispanics are going to become the majority population of America, in which Asians and many people from other backgrounds have come into our country and been successful and continue to be. And, of course, when you see their oppositional stand to everything that our first black American president has tried to do, combined with their anti-immigration policies, combined with their gay bashing, the homophobia, the misogyny, the kind of ripping of women who have taken a stand, you know, whether it's Rush Limbaugh or Fox News, whatever it might be, when you add it all up, I just think we have to honestly say we have a white male problem. Now, that doesn't mean all white males. I happen to be white, 60, and a male, last time I checked, are in the same boat. But it does mean that we have to be honest about why, for instance, the NRA has this group of people who are hanging on to assault weapons as if they're going to defend themselves, not against a burglar or go deer hunting, but as if their own government is a threat, or the United Nations is a threat, or they're joining secessionist movements, or they have been part of the whole Tea Party anti-Obama movement. And touch it where you may, there's this little core of people, and I don't think it's a huge number, but there's a core of people who sort of have controlled the Republican Party nominating process for the Senate and Congress and presidency, who have really shifted the Republican Party out of the mainstream and made it a radical fringe element in this country in terms of what it's done during the presidency of Barack Obama. And I think it comes from racism, but I think the less discussed aspect, because people are aware of racism, is it comes from this fear that grips this aging white male generation that really has become pivotal in not doing anything constructive, but in making everything other people are trying to do, whether it is to reform our laws on assault weapons or whether it's to reform the healthcare system, touch it where you may, you know, they are the pivot here. So I've written this piece in Alternet about the white male problem, and I hope it opens a discussion. And certainly given the number of comments there and the fact that it was their most read piece for a week, most emailed, most copied, most sent, most Facebook and all the rest of it, I think it did touch a nerve.
You're listening to More Talk Radio here on Your Community Connection, KBOO Portland, 90.7 in the city. We're speaking today with Frank Schaefer. We're speaking about his article, America's White Male Problem. But more importantly, we're going to try to delve into how to recognize and perhaps some solutions to addressing this. We started out by mentioning who you were to kind of get a little bit of your background and why we think that you have an excellent perspective on this. And you've talked about being involved in the founding, so to speak, of America's religious right, which, as you've also pointed out, is part of the overlay to this problem. Briefly, what do you see as some of the reasons why this particular group has hunkered down and is so fearful? I know we said it's the power shift, but given the fact that sometimes the best way to beat your enemy is to absorb your enemy,
sure,
is there no way that this particular demographic sees the ability to find any common ground?
Well, let me be very clear again, as I am at the beginning of the article. I talk about the South and I talk about white males. I'm not saying that that represents most men.
Oh, most definitely. No, I got that.
Certainly not most white males or most of anybody. But the fact of the matter is a very bigoted, frightened minority can really shift the politics from the center to either the left, as happened in the 70s when I was young and you had the Weather Underground bombing banks and killing cops in the name of leftist revolution, or to the right, as you have all these people today who are clinging to vast personal arsenals of assault weapons. And if you really dig, it has nothing to do with hunting or home protection. It's their sense of threat, apocalyptic threat, if they're kind of evangelical types, expecting these are the end times, all the way through to people who are secessionists and really believe that it's going to come down to a fight between them and the federal government of the United Nations or the IRS or whomever, just
yes,
in some kind of, you know, mm-hmm. I guess you just have to call it a delusional fantasy, but it's a delusional fantasy that's armed and it's dangerous and it's frightened. And these dealing with people who are scared of the future is not good for our country. So I think the first thing we have to do is be honest about the problem and not just think it's all politics or something to do with Republican and Democratic arguments as we've seen in the past. You know, this fringe has always been in America, but they have come to the forefront during the presidency of Barack Obama, and it's not a coincidence. But then I think there's something else going on, and that's just a much, much, much bigger historical paradigm, and that is the demographic shift. You know, we are, if we want to use the color chart here, we are going to become a brown country, not a predominantly white country. We're going to be a country that is no longer described as Judeo-Christian in a very few years, because you have 20%+ of the population declaring themselves atheists, less and less evangelical young people going to church, more and more Muslims and agnostics, as well as traditional other groups such as Jews and Hindus and others who have been part of our country for many years. And then you have the whole color situation changing. And so I think that you have the old-fashioned racist group hunkering down, but I think you have a kind of a new group that's been added to them, and that is that the people who look around and they just don't understand this country anymore. They don't get it, and they are fearful. They are getting older. It's a temporary problem. It's a demographic problem. They will go away. But in the meantime, they do weird things like send people to Congress, of which there's about 33 congressmen who are really the core of the Tea Party group there, the real, real hardliners who, for instance, are against Bonnier and his leadership because he's, from their point of view, compromises.
Mm-hmm.
And they're willing, literally, in things like the debt limit negotiations, to shut down the economy, to damage the faith and credit of the United States, to plunge us back into recession. Theirs is a kind of a scorched earth theology of pure idealism that never works in politics or religion or any other part of life, family life either. But we're in hock to these guys because of this white votership on the far right that has put us there by sending these guys to Congress from gerrymandered, rigged constituencies where they don't fear the general population, let alone popular opinion, because they're in safe districts that have been put together for them by state house legislators who are on the Republican right. And so it's not the end of our democracy and the sky is not falling, but it's definitely a big bump in the road, and we're going to have to find ways to get past it. And of course, this is going to be the challenge, particularly for our president during his next 4 years.
How do you perceive this challenge, and it certainly is it's a monumental challenge for this president, considering what you just said in terms of perceptions and feeling people feeling under threat. How do you propose what you say needs to be done in your article on the reintegration of those who feel marginalized into a common cause?
Well, let's be frank. I mean, this is just my opinion here. I don't have any inside knowledge. But as we all know, whether it's dealing with someone who is schizophrenic or has had brain damage or just snapped in some other ways, there are some lines that you can never bring a person back from after they cross
it.
There are some people who are just too far out there. There's nothing you could do to convince them. So somebody weaned, for instance, on a perpetual diet of Fox News fantasy fed to them by the likes of Glenn Beck for the last 5, 6, 7 years before he was thrown out of there and went on his own, really is going to be unreachable at a certain point if they believe that vision, because they have been fed a steady diet of apocalyptic fantasy and delusion. And if they're a little bit unstable, a little bit uneducated, a little bit angry, and their brain is really, you know, neurologically set in that pattern of hate and reaction, it's going to be very hard to talk anybody into something different. But the real defense, the best way to tackle this, is what President Obama is doing. You know, he does not appear angry. He doesn't answer these people in kind. He reaches out to the more moderate Republicans again and again, even though they slam his fingers in the door. And his tone is one that does not stoke the fire. Just thank God for his moderation is all I can say. In addition to which, I think success is the best answer, because a lot of these people in these secessionist groups, angry as they might be at having a black man in the White House, obviously that will go away at some point when we have somebody else in the White House. Hopefully there will be more black men and women in the White House at other times, but they'll have times when they see a white face there again, and it gets back to what they would call normal. But I think more than that, they can the hardcore people can never be folded back into the process, but those who are not so hardcore, who are just along for the ride because this moment in history and our recession and so forth temporarily have scared them, I think can be very much helped by the success of the economy. And if our president rebuilds this economy and our Congress does not completely go off the rails and damage it, that success, the fact that people do have jobs, the fact that the numbers tick up and the stock market looks good and people are hiring, that's really the only, quote, answer, because the answer is not going to be intellectual. We won't convince these folks, but if we can remove the personal element of feeling threatened, say, by the economy, the loss of a job, and these other things, then we've gone a long way to at least blunting the impact of these folks. So, you know, what we have to fear is that the far-right Republican-controlled Congress hurts the economy enough so that it simply stokes the flames of those people who say, see, I told you, you know, we were going to hell in a handcart, and it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. And that, of course, is what President Obama is up against and probably working night and day, I'm sure he is, to do something about. And obviously, the calmer his tone as he works these problems, the better. And like I say, I'm just amazed at his even-handed, even-tempered approach to these things, and it has to be other people like us who talk about them.
You're listening to More Talk Radio here on your community radio station, KBOO. My name is Cecil Prescott. I'm here with my co-host, Celeste Carey. We're speaking with Frank Schaefer, the author of a recent article on Alternate, America's White Male Problem. Give us a call and respond to Mr. Schaefer's article and his suggestions. Our numbers here are 503-231-8187, or you may email us at moretalkradio at gmail.com. We're not so concerned in terms of debating the presidential policies. That's another show, another time. But in terms of Mr. Schaefer's analysis of what he considers a pathology and how do we get our way out of it, let's go to Randy.
Good morning, Randy.
Hi. What's scary is that people take you seriously, Mr. Schaefer.
Hey, well, my wife would agree with that sometimes, but what do you mean by that?
Well, in some ways, you've described me perfectly. I fit much of what you've described, but then you add on all these. You make me the radical. You know, you sound like the radical, like, in spades.
Well, hey, correct where you think I'm wrong. Let's hear it. I'm up for being instructed. What do you disagree with?
Okay, well, it couldn't be, it has to be because he has black skin. It couldn't be because of his radical Marxist agenda. He said it, we're 5 days away from fundamentally transforming the United States of America. Well, a lot of us object to that.
Well, you know, if you're talking about radical Marxism, you know, as someone who, you know, has studied a little actual radical Marxism, when you look at the fact that most of Barack Obama's criticism has come from the left in this country, not the right, when it comes to his economic policies as being far too favorable to corporate America, you know, I don't know where you're getting that information from, but maybe you would be someone who is getting it from some of these alternative sources of information like Fox or whatever else that, frankly, I don't think have been telling the truth.
It doesn't matter where I got it. I can see for myself that he's running the debt up astronomically, and he's taking from one class, the so-called wealthy, and handing it over to the people that didn't work for it. That's redistributionist Marxism.
Well, you know, I'm glad that you make that point, because I think that there's a debate about issues such as the debt, but they have to be very separate from the fact that I also think that there are a lot of people out there, and of course I don't know you, so I wouldn't categorize you as one of them, but who are functioning on a basis of fearing this president that I just frankly regard as irrational in the light of his actual track record and where he falls in the broad center. You know, my son served in the Marine Corps out in Afghanistan for two tours and in Iraq, and what's interesting to me is what a better commander-in-chief and how much more effective President Obama has been than someone who I actually know personally. I don't know this president personally, but I did know George Bush personally. In fact, got nice notes from him on handwritten letterhead thanking our family for my son's service when he was my son's commander-in-chief. The fact is, you know, when you look at the actual track record, Barack Obama has been more of a hawk than George Bush was in terms of effectively prosecuting the war on terror, and yet, you know, the religious right and others have consistently lied about him as somehow being soft on these issues. I think the same is true for the economy. I think he's been very centrist. In fact, as someone who's probably liberal in my views on economics, to the left, certainly, of where the Republican Party is today, I think a lot of times he's been too favorable to Wall Street. So far from being a redistributionist, you know, most people who make a living studying economics feel that he's to the right of center on these issues. So I just don't agree with your point of view. I thank you, though, for your courteous tone in taking me on, and I hope I've reciprocated.
Thank you, Randy, for calling. Mr. Schaefer, was this in the early 80s? I want you to, and you've been quite honest about this, about your own background, but in terms of the development of the religious right, early on, many people might have gotten acquainted with you as a filmmaker, and you, I'm not sure, I can't recall whether you did this film project with your father.
Sure, I did, yes.
Which set the ground for a lot of the religious right.
Yeah, well, we made two film projects together in the early and mid-70s. One was a series called How Should We Then Live, about art and culture from the point of view of evangelical Christianity. It really became the basic teaching tool for literally tens of thousands of Christian high schools, churches, colleges, and others. In fact, the book has remained a bestseller for years. And the last couple of chapters of the book and the last few episodes of the film series dealt with the issue of Roe v. Wade that actually happened in 73 while we were filming. And so the episodes were rewritten to incorporate a kind of an evangelical pro-life slash anti-abortion view in the films. Because those got such a wide hearing, we then made a second series, as I talk about in my book, Crazy for God. I, in fact, lay out this in great detail because it was pivotal to the rise of the religious right in America. But, you know, in Crazy for God, I describe how we got together with Dr. C. Everett Koop, who at that time was Surgeon-in-Chief of Philadelphia Children's Hospital, later went on to become Ronald Reagan's Surgeon General, and really was, along with my father, the founder of what you'd call the Protestant evangelical wing of the pro-life movement. Before that, Protestants were divided. For instance, Dr. Criswell, who was the Southern Baptist chairman of the convention and also the president of the Southern Baptist Seminary in Dallas and also the pastor of First Baptist in Dallas, you know, you can't get a more evangelical than Criswell was. You know, he did not believe abortion was murder, nor did the Harold Lindzel, the editor of Christianity Today magazine. And basically, Dad, through the series we made together that I wrote and directed, How Should We Then Live, and then Whatever Happened to the Human Race, by the time we were done with a 20-city seminar tour in which we put those series in front of tens of thousands of people, as I describe in the book, you know, the opinion had shifted. And so really what happened was not so much that my dad founded the quote-unquote religious right, but he gave the religious right its first huge issue, which was then used by the Republican Party to get what had been blue-collar Democrats in places like Pennsylvania or others to vote for them, really against their own economic interests, but on the basis of what they regarded as these higher principles, whether it was abortion, prayer in schools, and later on gay rights, women's rights, feminism, all these things which ran counter to right-wing evangelical thinking. And so Dad was not really associated with all those other issues, but because our film series were so effective back in the 70s, he made the abortion issue the kind of key litmus test. And as you know, it still controls a great deal of the Republican primary process on the state and national level today. And so in that sense, in reading Crazy for God, you're really reading a piece of how we got where we are. And then, of course, it's supremely ironic that for the last 30 years, I have really been sliding away from many of those positions and now, you know, am somewhat hated and vilified by the very people who, in a way, our books and film series set up in terms of their key issues, because I have changed my mind on these things and did so many years ago, seeing where the religious right was going and the extremes to which it was going. And in fact, I'm sad to say that I think I was proved right in the fact that that's where it went. And it really did, in the end, derail the Republican Party and turn it into something completely other than a normal party. But if you look at, say, the impact of people like Rush Limbaugh, Fox News, Glenn Beck, these guys basically reap the rewards, if you want to put it that way, of the doors that Dad, Dr. Koop, other people opened, Dr. Dobson, Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson, and others, that first wave of religious right activists, opened a door to a kind of a right-wing slash political religious philosophy that then has been pushed forward by a lot of these other folks. And so, you know, we were part of that history, and that's what the book is about.
We're speaking with Frank Schaefer. Our numbers are 503-231-8187. His article on alternate.org has gotten a lot of attention, America's White Male Problem. What do you think of his analysis, and how do we create a future in where all people feel welcome? Let's go to Sean. Thank you for waiting.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Mr. Schaefer. Mr. Schaefer, it's really upsetting to me to hear the far right-wing saturation on our airwaves out here in the Portland area. You know, we have these 50,000-watt FM blowtorches, and they're just like spewing out this Glenn Beck stuff. I know in the first Great Depression, there was Father Coughlin and his extreme right-wing views.
Right.
I've been increasingly alarmed about the fact that this whack job, Alex Jones, is basically spinning this tale of Wall Street bankers supporting the communist revolution. I mean, I wonder, does he even realize that he's basically reading straight out of Mein Kampf? I mean, that's like pure Nazi ideology. And so I guess my question would be, what do you make of this? These strange bedfellows of this kind of Ayn Rand objectivist libertarian stuff being fused in some bizarre fashion with Judeo-Christian values. I know like people like Cornel West and Tavis Smiley have gone on a poverty tour lately, trying to bring, you know, light on the issues of poverty in the U.S. But this bizarre connection that these far-right wingers are making between Judeo-Christian values and the kind of satanic Ayn Rand objectivist ideology. I was wondering if you'd comment on that. Thanks.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a terrific point. It cuts to the heart of the whole problem in a very profound way. There are so many stories being told here by what you are saying. Look, let's just take one. The religious right comes to our shores in the United States with some Roman Catholic participation from some of the more conservative bishops, but mostly it's an evangelical phenomena. The evangelicals, if nothing else, historically were people who were supposedly, and in fact were, interested in people's personal salvation, as they would put it, coming to know Jesus or being born again. If you look at the shift that has occurred, that this has become the voting bloc who has actually sent to Congress more consistently than any other group, people who have adopted Ayn Rand's scorched earth philosophy of, you know, let the poor eat cake and meanwhile let's benefit from the super wealthy becoming even wealthier at the expense of the poor, this kind of survival of the fittest paradigm taken to its ultimate conclusion, which now is actually happening in this country in terms of the disparity between the rich and the poor, say, compared to the 1950s. You know, you see two stories. You see a pollution of our political process we've been talking about on this program, but if I was an evangelical still interested in seeing people, quote, saved and coming to believe in Jesus, I would be shuddering because my movement, had I still been that person, has been now taken over in the political arena by people who really are genuinely anti-Christ. I don't mean they are anti-Christ, but they are against the teaching of Jesus. There's no other way to see what they're saying. And so the corruption and the pollution of the political process is as nothing compared to the corruption of the image of the Christian gospel and witness in the United States. And I think where you see this most clearly is when you realize that, for instance, I was around in the 1970s when we were launching the evangelical wing of the pro-life movement, as I talk about in Crazy for God. And our agenda never even got near including, for instance, the rights of the super wealthy not to pay taxes on dividends. Now, all of a sudden, after people like the Koch brothers and Fox News and others have folded this into the mix, you have evangelicals in the name of Christianity and Christ out there actually denying their basic theology and instead putting forward this Ayn Randian idea that somehow the only purpose of life, far from being to help the poor or the needy or even have family values in the old Christian sense, is to kind of have this worshipful adulation of wealth, prosperity, and industry. And you really see a corruption not just in the politics but in the educational field, for instance, where we are teaching to the test, preparing students to compete in the quote-unquote global economy, having forgotten that the traditional Christian view of education that, for instance, was in 19th century America, is that education was about the soul. It was about values. It was about art. It was about beauty. It was about learning for its own sake. So there are a lot of streams folded together here, the kind of traditional evangelical anti-intellectualism folded into these utilitarian views, this Ayn Randian kind of scorched earth view of the economy and the preeminence of the super wealthy. I think if I was an evangelical, I'd really be thinking that the story of this movement that I tell in Crazy for God is really the story of the old proverb about the frog that can be boiled. If you turn the heat up 1 degree at a time, it never knows it's being boiled to death until it dies. Had you, for instance, at our seminars in 1976, stood up and said, where the movement we're starting tonight will lead is to worship of the rich, denial of the poor, lies about our first black American president, fear-mongering on a scale that can't be believed by an entire secessionist movement who are actually traitors to the United States of America when you look at the essence of what they're saying, this is what we're beginning. I think every single evangelical in that crowd would have walked out. But because it's been done incrementally and has been subverted by some people with some heavy political agendas, and in the case of Fox News, some economic ones, and then sheer nutcases like the Glenn Becks of this world that have been given a stage and a megaphone, you know, what you see here is a Pandora's box that's been opened, and it's anybody's guess when it can ever be put back in.
You're listening to More Talk Radio here on your Community Connection, KBOO Portland, 90.7 here in the city. My name is Celeste Carey. I'm here with my guest, Cecil Prescott. We are speaking with Frank Schaefer. We are referencing his article, America's White Male Problem, and we're discussing not only how this demographic has a grip, and a fearful grip, no less, on our front pages and on our political and economic system, but perhaps looking at some ways that we could relax that grip and move from beyond this reaction of fear to a reaction of change. Join us, 503-231-8187, and we'll go to Karen. Thank you for holding patiently, Karen. Good morning.
Sure. Hi. You know, this is amazing. I'm really, really glad to hear this show and your guest. I completely agree with your perspective. And I think Ayn Rand would have been flabbergasted at the previous election to have her have her associations where they were placed. But you
or
know,
not.
One of the things that occurs to me is, you know, there is a shift of wealth. And, you know, your first caller mentioned that, but, you know, people that have that kind of awareness aren't looking at where that shift is occurring and to whom it is going to. It's not, you know, poor people. It's the very top level of everyone in our country. And I think of it in terms of apartheid. And I know that might seem like a reach, but, you know, when you just look at the numbers and the power and all the other things that you've been talking about, that I don't know. I'd be interested in your comments, you know, your perspective on that. I just want to say one other thing in terms of the change. And Howard Zinn, of course, you know, the wonderful Howard Zinn, really felt strongly that it's one step at a time. You know, the South did change, but it took a lot of us. And we're not just one David, you know, like the poster that you talked about, but we are many Davids against the Goliath, and if we all do our thing and educate and talk and act, then we can have an impact, and a really positive impact.
Thank you for your call, Karen.
Thanks,
Karen. And points.
You know, thanks for the great comment, Karen. I would just say that from my point of view, I like your apartheid analogy. I actually lived in South Africa for a year back in the 80s when it was still an apartheid state. And the interesting thing to me is we always think of color when we say apartheid, but also class. And so the strange and the sad thing is that the very group of white males that I talk about in this article is being taken advantage of in a way by a predominantly white, although race is not the interesting point here, it's the wealth aspect, an oligarchy of the super wealthy who have so manipulated the political process that it really is that the most disadvantaged folks, who often are the very ones who are stockpiling their weapons and looking in the wrong direction. It's really been a kind of a sleight of hand trick here I'm not in any sense a conspiracy theorist, but it has been one where the wealthiest people in this country have followed their own interests out to the limit, really used the Republican Party. And I think the most obvious example is that because of issues like abortion and gay rights and others that so many Republican rank and file vote on, about which the Republican hierarchy care nothing, they won't even let these folks caddy for them on their golf courses. You know, people like the Koch brothers live in a completely different universe. They have no interest whatsoever in these agendas other than the one they inherited from their father, who was a leader in the John Birch Society, another harebrained right-wing group, but in those days who had not taken over the Republican Party, because in the Koch brothers' father's time, people like William F. Buckley wrote against the extremists and purged the Republican Party of them for a time and through the National Review. And then, of course, these folks have all come surging back. Look, they're not interested in abortion. They're not interested in gay rights. They are not interested in these issues. They don't care about prayer in schools or the Ten Commandments being posted or the rights of gun owners to carry assault weapons or have 30-round magazine clips. So what they care about is keeping the status quo the same, where gradually the ship bearing all the wealthy, kind of like the first class in the Titanic, is always safe. So they always come first, and then whatever the crumbs are left can go to the guys down in second and third class in steerage. And, of course, like the Titanic, to push that analogy a little further, when it sinks, when there's trouble, the super wealthy get in the lifeboats and everybody else goes down with the ship, more or less, which is what actually happened with the Titanic, but also, with a few exceptions, but also is happening in our economy. And so all you have to do is look at a chart. I mean, there's no argument here. These are facts. These are numbers. If you look at the disparity, for instance, between what a CEO was paid in 1952 or 56 and what a CEO gets today, in those days the disparity was anywhere between 11 to the most being about 25, 30 times more than the rank-and-file employee. Today it's many thousands of times. On and on it goes. The numbers don't lie. And so I think a lot of lower middle class whites, or people in even an underclass who are white and a bit frightened of these times, and others, people who have other colors as well, it's not just white people, really see the line at the wrong place. It's not a black-white divide, it's a class divide between the underclass and the super wealthy, the 1%. And really, they have managed to do something remarkable by making these social agendas paramount and by financing people like Glenn Beck and Fox News, which Rupert Murdoch has financed, and others like him, by using these shrill, crazy mouthpieces in this time of conflict, especially with an African-American president. They have managed to divert a lot of attention away from a problem where they are reaping the benefits of a global economy, and the middle class and the lower middle class are standing holding the bag. And that's really the big story here. That's the overarching story. So the lies that a lot of the white underclass are sucking up, thinking that if they cling to their assault weapons, they're somehow going to be protected, these aren't going to protect them at all, because, you know, the Marines aren't coming looking for them. But the system itself is now weighted in favor of the super wealthy to the point that it's I think touch and go whether we can turn this ship around, and I hope we do. And I'm not pessimistic about the future, because I think we're slowly making some incremental changes. But I think we've got to get past this thing where we take seriously the issues that get waved around in our face and answer them all the time without looking at the deeper underlying structural problems, which I think are the real issue.
You attack the press for being not going vigorously against the religious right. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, attack maybe is yes. Strong. Uh-huh. I don't know, but I certainly say that we ought to honestly look at these issues. For instance, we ought to look at the honest issue of the fact that if you take this group of white male older voters out of the mix who are living in fear of the future, the Republican Party would not be in the grip of extremists. And I think the same thing goes for evangelical Christians. They have to take their medicine and admit the fact that they have helped derail the Republican Party and push it into the extremist column to the point where it's no longer a traditional party. What it is today is a kind of a ragtag collection of extremists who can't get any business done except obstruct whatever progress the government could otherwise make. And that's as bad for the Republican Party as it is for anyone else. Look, Jack Kemp, who ran as Dole's running mate and who was House Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, under Reagan was a personal friend of mine. I stayed in Jack and Joanne's home many, many times. This is a traditional Republican, as Bill Buckley was a friend of our family. These people would be appalled by the direction it's taken. Jack would not believe what he's seen. In fact, about 15 years before he died, when I started writing pretty vociferously against the religious right, Jack called me one time. He said, "Hey, you're right. These folks are not conservatives. They're radicals, and they're going to destroy the party." Well, he's been proved correct. They have destroyed the party that people like Jack Kemp built. So it isn't a question of being anti-conservative. It's a question of saying the Republican Party is no longer a traditional party. It's a collection of radicals, or at least in most cases being run by a collection of radicals, who are so far outside the mainstream that had the lunatic voices of people like Rush Limbaugh and Glenn Beck and Fox News not been given a billion-dollar megaphone by the likes of Rupert Murdoch and the Koch brothers, no one would ever hear of these guys. But in today's mix, and then you add the reaction against having a black president, you have something pretty volatile, the likes of which hasn't been seen in America since the reaction to FDR.
You're listening to More Talk Radio. Our guest is Frank Schaefer. We'll go to our calls, but first let me remind you that coming up on KBOO at 9 is the Elmo Variety Hour. The topics include anarchism and Marxism, the movie Zero Dark Thirty, and the book Sasha and Emma. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia. At 10:15 on Locus Focus, host Barbara Bernstein speak with the environmental magazine editor, Britta Belli, about what we know and don't know about the impact of proliferation nanoparticles in our food supply. At 11 on Health Watch, Dr. Naiman interviews Dr. Gary Weiner, naturopathic physician and founder of Pearl Natural Health, about natural approaches to improving immunity during the flu season. At 11:30, the guest is G. Randon Gaston, author of Just Trust Me, Finding Truth in a World of Spin. Gaston is a civil litigation attorney, shares strategies for critical thinking and fact-finding. Thank you, KBOO members and listeners, for your support. If you are not a member, you can go to kbo.fm and click on the Donate Today button.
Absolutely. And we're going to go to our next caller. Good morning, Brian. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thanks for having this discussion. This is awesome. I have a kind of a personal history similar to Mr. Schaefer's, in that my father was a Baptist minister and I grew up in the pretty conservative religious situation, but I've taken a similar direction as he has, obviously not as effectively, but I just wanted to thank him so much for the discussion that he had with the first caller, and it was like a model for so many of us out here how to deal with those situations, and I know myself I've failed miserably getting too irate, and that was just such a beautiful model. I actually wish that it could have continued longer, because I almost needed to go take notes. Mm-hmm. And thank you for that model for so many of us on how to deal with that sort of thinking. And that was my main point. Thank you.
Well, thanks so much for your comment. And, you know, going back to that first caller, everybody has a point to make, including, obviously, as you know, those we disagree with. But honestly, and I don't mean this in some maudlin, you know, pat yourself on the back sense, but I regard a lot of people as genuine victims of tremendously wealthy, very cynical folks who have engineered the U.S. political system over the last 30 years very deliberately in their favor. It's not some nefarious plot. You know, there's a wonderful documentary simply called Park Avenue, which where they're interviewing the doormen of folks like the Koch brothers, who with their billions of dollars give the chintziest tips at Christmas time to their doormen. And, you know, these are folks who live out the Ayn Rand dream. They have nothing to do with the kind of people who are watching Fox News and sucking this stuff up raw and unfiltered and believing it. So, you know, I get a lot of hate mail from these folks time to time when someone like Rush Limbaugh attacks me on air, but after that all quiets down, most people I meet or talk to who take these other positions are folks who I think have, really are in a situation where they have been taken advantage of, and you know that's how I see it. But that doesn't mean we can change everybody's minds. But I think we need to see clearly that the enemy is not the 99% of people who are in the same boat the rest of us are with different politics. It's really a cynical group of people who have manipulated the Republican Party in their favor by playing on the fears you know, take the NRA. The NRA doesn't care what they stand for, and they don't believe a word of it. They are the shills of a $10, $20 billion gun lobby interest group that makes billions of dollars off selling weapons nobody needs to people who are fearful for their lives in a day and age when crime's actually gone down, when an assault weapon is the most useless home defense weapon in the world. As a father of a Marine who scored expert on the 500-yard range and owns a gun myself, I can tell you if you want to defend your home, you just need a good old-fashioned shotgun, if you're so minded, and a .22 for the woodchucks. No, you know, these assault weapons are useless pieces of equipment for anything except mass murder. And yet, you know, you have people collecting them by the dozens at these gun shows and stocking up on ammunition and stripping the shelves bare because the NRA lies to them and says Barack Obama wants to take away all your weapons. And when you look at the paradigm going on there, the NRA is nothing but a lobbying group. They don't care about gun rights. 73% of the members of the NRA say that they believe in reform of our gun laws to keep guns out of the hands of criminals and insane people, and yet the NRA won't go along with it. That's a very clear model of the business model, the greed, the wealth, the super wealthy, twisting the concerns and fears of a group of people they depend on to stay in power. And of course, that just keeps playing out all the way down the line in so many, so many areas. And it's the way primarily, as I talk about in Crazy for God, that the pro-life movement has been used by the Republican Party to its advantage, without actually changing anything on Roe v. Wade, which would have changed years ago had the Republicans said, for instance, what we're going to do is paid leave for men and women when they have children, single-payer health care for young moms so that they don't have to worry about that, daycare and training for women, all the rest of this. None of these things were put into practice. That's what you do if you want to lower the abortion rate, contraceptives in high school, real sex education, et cetera, across the board. None of these things were done. Instead, we just, you know, clash the cymbals, beat our chests, talk about these issues as moral issues rather than practically. Nothing is done, but we keep electing people who go to Washington who actually their real agenda is totally different, and it's about Wall Street, et cetera, et cetera. So this just goes on and on and on and on and on, and I genuinely feel sorry for the folks caught up in it. Hey, I used to be one of them. I was someone who was in this mix, believing every word of it, 25, 30 years ago, well, actually 30, 35 years ago, and got out. Well, there was still time to do something different with my life, as I write about, but I don't look at these guys as them as opposed to us. We're all in the same boat. We are American citizens being taken advantage of by a filthy rich oligarchy who will do anything to hang on to what they've got.
So how do we work with this group? As I asked earlier, you know, is there no way to look at them and talk with them and have a meeting of the minds? I'm thinking, hearing you, maybe what we need to do is kind of isolate them like an oyster isolates an irritating substance, you know, like a grain of sand, and just kind of coat them with kindness and go on about our business. But how do we work with this group who really is so hunkered and bunkered that they have no, there's no bridge, there's no ideology that can reach them?
Yeah, I think, Celeste, you make a good point. I don't think you can work with a lot of folks, but I think what we can do is keep hammering away at the real problem, and that is instead of hammering away at the surface issues, talk about the underlying problem. For instance, as I do in the article, the fear of a certain group of people in the white underclass who are genuinely frightened that the future has no place for them. Well, a rising economy will prove them wrong. Now, it won't prove the fringe wrong, but it will change the minds of a lot of people who are living two-hand-to-mouth now, precisely because they keep electing folks who don't care about them. So I think a lot of us have a very high stake to do what we can practically in the next 4 years to see that the Obama administration succeeds. I think we have a very high stake in working against the lobbying groups and trying to reform the financing of our local, state, and national elections. I think we have a very high stake on always supporting any initiative to get the lobbyists out of Washington and make it hard for them to manipulate the system. It's not one size fits all, but once you accept the idea that the oligarchy, the powerful lobbies, the money has to be curbed, then any time we get an opportunity to do that, I think 90% of the time we can be on the side of those issues and help our elected officials succeed. Speak up. You know, send in the petitions, call and write people, but more than that, just keep voting for people who aren't afraid of the gun lobby, who won't do what the Koch brothers say, who get up publicly like someone like Barney Frank does and consistently takes on the national lobbies, speak honestly about the military-industrial complex and the fact that we don't need a military 17 times bigger than all the rest of the world combined, and so on. Whatever we touch this, I think it's a question of speaking up and voting our conscience and not being silent about what's going on. And when it gets to the people ground up in the machinery, like the white underclass who really believe that a 100-round ammunition clip keeps them safe from a big, bad federal government, I just think there, in truth and in sincerity and in love and in quiet tones, we need to keep telling an opposite story. And that is, you know, what's really dangerous to those folks is the fact that their daughter can't afford to go to college. What's really dangerous to those folks is that they will go bankrupt if health care reform is derailed if they get cancer. What's mm-hmm. really dangerous to those folks is that their paycheck is getting smaller all the time while people like the Koch brothers is getting richer. So we just have to keep telling that story, and I think that's it. It's not the solution. It's a series of small solutions.
So in other words, connect with each other in truth and love.
I think so when it comes down to the level of individuals, and then on the national scale, you know, tell it like it is and point the finger and be willing to argue the point.
Let's see if we can get one more caller in. Paul, good morning.
Good morning. This is a really valuable, important approach that you're bringing up. But I also, I don't see how you can avoid the question of whether Obama is actually addressing the systemic nature of the problem, is actually addressing oligarchy, and, you know, beyond that, whether the Democratic Party, whether there's any combination of forces, any force within the political establishment, within the system as it's constituted, that is actually capable of addressing the systemic problem. And I guess connected is, like, you know, the Occupy movement did seem to try to bring up some sort of populist kind of discourse that was capable of bringing up a new language, and I don't see Obama picking up on that, or anybody very much, not hardly anybody in the political establishment picking up on that at all.
Okay. I think two things are going on. Thanks for the question. I think it's a great point. Of course, this is just my own personal opinion, but I think two things have happened here. One, it's amazing that President Obama has achieved anything, given the label of the level of vile, unfounded rhetoric he's faced and obstruction by Congress. I think he's accomplished a great deal. But that said, I think that his second term will have to play out for some of these other things to be done, and a lot of them are not going to get done because this oligarchy is so entrenched that all that can happen is the beginning and continuation of a very long-term process. Look, it took us 30 years to spin down into this mix, and it's going to take us a long time to climb out. All I would say is that Barack Obama has managed to point us somewhat in a better direction. That doesn't sound like much, but it's a heck of a lot better than the alternative, and I thoroughly believe that.
Well, thank you so much for your calls. Frank Schaefer, we want to thank you so much for coming on board, for having a delightful and illuminating conversation with us, but more importantly, for letting us know that the most important issue, again, in this situation is how we work with each other as we recognize, as you put it so succinctly, we're all in this together.
Yeah, and Cecil and Celeste, thank you for the opportunity here to talk about these issues. I really appreciate the program and the station, and just thanks for having me on. It's nice to touch a couple of friends up there, you know, through your radio station in a part of the world that I think is very beautiful. So thanks for having me as your guest.
And we'd love to have you back again in the future.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to More Talk Radio here on Your Community Connection, KBOO Portland.
And a quick announcement, there's an Interfaith Moral Action on Climate in a Pray-In for Climate in front of the Benton County Courthouse, which will be held 5 p.m. Tuesday, January 15th, in the Benton County Courthouse.
That's right. Stay tuned. We have more coming up for you, Cecil, and I will be off next week. It is a day on, though, not a day off, as we celebrate Dr. Martin Luther King's birthday. Stay tuned because we have more news and information for you here on Your Community Connection, KBOO Portland.
KABU Radio is a proud media sponsor of the Fertile Ground Festival of New Work, a 10-day festival showcasing all new acts of creation by Portland artists. This festival will take place from January 24th through February 3rd in locations all over Portland and aspires to increase the appreciation of Portland's lush creative culture, artists, and projects spawned right here in our native soil. Again, that's the Fertile Ground Festival of New Work from January 24th through February 3rd. More information can be found at kabu.fm/fertileground2013.
On Wednesday, January 16th, KABU will broadcast the talk by Michelle Alexander on the new Jim Crow, racism and the criminal justice system, along with a community forum on police and the Portland community. Listen to the talk live on KABU Radio from 5:30 p.m. to 8 p.m. this coming Wednesday on 90.7 FM and also heard on the web at kabu.fm.
And get together, break up this old Jim Crow.
I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland, Oregon, 90.7 FM. This is listener-supported community radio. It's time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Denise Morris, your host for this January 14th Monday. Joe Clement is our engineer. This morning on the Old Mole, we have on tap a lot of talk about anarchism and a critical look at the national security state in action on film. We opened this morning's show with movie mole Jan Hawken talking with Stephen Reisner about the new film Zero Dark Thirty, directed by Catherine Bigelow and written by Mark Boll. The filmmaking duel who brought us the much-acclaimed film The Hurt Locker